Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Lochbaum, one of the nation's top independent experts on nuclear power. He formerly worked for the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and now serves as director of the Nuclear Safety Project at the Union of Concerned Scientists. And he is the co-author of the new book just out, Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Lochbaum.
Thank you, Ian, for having me on.
And on March the 11th of 2011, this extraordinary 1-2 punch happened with a magnitude 9 earthquake, which was a natural disaster, but then it triggered a man-made disaster, causing the Fukushima Daiichi's 6 boiling water reactors to lose off-site electric power as the 50-foot tsunami crashed in and knocked out the backup diesel generators. And then a series of disasters unfolded over the days and continue to this day, do they not?
Well, the cleanup from the disasters definitely continue to this day and will for many years into the future.
And what is the sense of what the real legacy of this is? Because here in California, for example, we just learned that they're testing the kelp beds in the oceans off Malibu, California, for radiation from Fukushima.
Yeah, there were 3 reactor cores that melted down at Fukushima, and while much of that radioactivity that was released was contained within the thick concrete walls that surround the reactor vessels, because of various problems, quite a bit of that radiation was released to the air and water. So the ocean currents carried it across the Pacific, and the air currents carried it to China and even to the Aleutian Islands. So it was detected around the world, even though it was largely a local problem in terms of people having to evacuate and contaminated lands that will remain for decades.
So it's presumably the people on the land near the Fukushima Daiichi plants, they're the ones that are suffering the most.
Yes, to this day, almost 3 years after the event, there are tens of thousands of people who can't go home, or their homes are contaminated to levels that they'll probably never be able to return to those lands. So they're dislocated. And that problem will continue into the future as rainfall washes radiation from places today to different places tomorrow. Also, some of the radiation will be absorbed by plants and shrubbery and trees, and in the future, fires will free up that radioactivity to once again circulate far and wide.
So the more we talk about this, the more one gets the feeling that, you know, ever since the nuclear age, we've been playing with fire, and there's sort of a Faustian bargain, is there not, here with nuclear power. I mean, obviously, going back to Einstein and other physicists, the notion of a uncontrolled nuclear chain reaction, which is a nuclear bomb, was always considered sort of bad physics, I guess. And the trick has always been to do a controlled reaction. But that in itself is not necessarily under control.
Well, it's nuclear power has a lot of advantages, and there's also some thorns on that nuclear rose that, if not properly managed, can cause a lot of problems, as they did at Fukushima and they did at Chernobyl in 86 and so on. The advantage of nuclear power is you get an awful lot of energy from a small amount of material, whether it's the warhead of a bomb or the engine of a nuclear power plant. The downside is if you don't handle that right, that small amount of material can cause quite a bit of harm. And that's the other aspect of nuclear power, is that you know, 80% is not a passing grade. You have to be right all the time. I remember reading in the Wall Street Journal 5 years after the Chernobyl accident that the cleanup from that one accident outweighed the economic benefits from dozens of reactors that had operated in the former Soviet Union for decades up till that accident. So there was one bad day at one plant wiped out benefits accrued over decades from dozens of other plants. And that not many other technologies have that risk-reward profile.
Well, my understanding is that Admiral Rickover, the father of the nuclear navy, and after all, it was the nuclear reactor that propelled the submarines that were scaled up to become the basis of these nuclear power plants, these light water reactors, And Rickover, apparently, to this day, the U.S. Navy isn't allowed to bring its nuclear-powered fleet into some of the big ports. And Rickover always believed that nuclear power was so dangerous in the sense that you've just described, that you either have to have 100% certainty nothing happens, but when something does, it outweighs the benefits because of the catastrophic nature of a meltdown. He felt that civilian nuclear power should be under the control of the military, because only military discipline would be sufficient to contain the beast, if you will. Is that your understanding?
Exactly. Both of my parents worked for the Westinghouse Electric Corporation, who had contracts with Admiral Rickover, and both have told me stories about dealings with the Admiral. One of the advantages that Admiral Rickover had that you alluded to was the military didn't have to worry about the bottom line or the profit margins as much. You know, they had a job to do, and as long as he went to Congress and got funded, he could instill that discipline and mandate high standards that everybody had to meet. When you go to the civilian nuclear power, particularly in an open marketplace where you're competing with non-nuclear sources of electricity, the bottom line becomes more and more important and becomes more and more tempting to take some safety shortcuts so that you can remain profitable. So it is, Admiral Rickover felt that in order to best control that temptation, take it out of the hands of the private industry and keep it in government control.
And you wrote this book along with your colleague at the Union of Concerned Scientists, the physicist Edwin Lyman, and Susan Stranathan, who was a lead reporter on the Philadelphia Inquirer's Pulitzer Prize-winning coverage of the Three Mile Island nuclear accident. And this book that you've written that's just out now really sort of reads like a thriller. It's quite disturbing and gripping at the same time. The story of trying to contain this accident as it unfolds, and the lack of information that was coming forth from the Japanese company TEPCO is pretty extraordinary. And to this day, what assurances do we have that we know the full story, given the cozy relationship that the regulators and the power plants had in Japan, which somewhat mirrors the relationship we have here in this country between nuclear power plants and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which you recently worked on?
Yeah, I think the relationship between the company TEPCO in Japan and the regulator is less of a factor than the radiation and the widespread damage that was done is basically preventing a CSI nuclear, if you will. It's difficult to get into certain areas to figure out what happened, what damage was caused by the earthquake, what damage was caused by the tsunami, what damage was caused by the hydrogen explosions, and so on, because many areas of the plant still can't be entered by humans today, at least not except by suicide missions. So they're using remote-controlled vehicles and drones and cameras on fiber-optic cables to try to look into areas that people can't go. And so, therefore, the full story of what happened and why is not known, because it's just not knowable for many years into the future. We do know some things today that we didn't know right in the immediate days and weeks after the accident, because of samples of water that were taken and so on that helped give more insights. It's basically like a jigsaw puzzle. We have turned over some of the pieces, so we're starting to see a picture, but there's many pieces yet to be turned over to get the full story.
But the drama of the story is rather like The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which is the nature of a meltdown, right? That you've got to contain this runaway extreme heat, and they just poured all of this water and all of this seawater on it. And we don't quite know the full tally of that, do we? And it's still, no. Today, this day, they keep pouring more water on it, don't they? These cores haven't really cooled yet, have they?
Well, they've cooled a little bit, but and they have more margin than they definitely had 2.5 years ago, but there's still a need to continue to circulate water through the reactor cores to prevent even further damage. One of the things that was interesting to me in doing the research for the book was the many challenges that the workers had in dealing with that. The ultimate irony of being right next to the Pacific Ocean and having three reactor cores melt down because you couldn't get water to them is tragic and ironic. The other problem the workers had was that they had a number of pumps a number of things that they might have been able to employ to get water into the reactor vessels and prevent that outcome. But there was darkness because of the loss of power. They were, in many places, they were wading through 18 to 24 inches of water in darkness. The earthquake and tsunami had lifted some manholes out of their place, so they ran a risk of stepping into an open manhole and drowning. And there were also many, many aftershocks after the big quake. So they, and then they had three explosions at the site due to hydrogen that they were definitely not prepared for. So they faced, they were very heroes in taking the actions they did. In addition to the threats they faced at the plant site, it was also revealing to note that they had families at home who sometimes they didn't know if they'd survived the earthquake and tsunami or were being properly cared for. So they had all the problems facing them at work coupled with just unimaginable problems at home, and that I wouldn't have wanted to trade shoes with any of them.
Well, of course, that's one of the ironies that I think people have a hard time getting their heads around with nuclear power, is that the nuclear power plant depends so much upon electricity, backup electricity, off-site electricity.
Yeah, that's that was, at least within the industry, that's been known for years. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the 80s analyzed a scenario very similar to what happened at Fukushima with complete loss of power. And the Fukushima accident followed that timeline, not quite to the minute, but it was, it pretty much followed that script that had been written back in the 80s. So it was known that if you lose power to a nuclear power plant, you've only got minutes to hours to undo that problem before things get very, very bad. And unfortunately, even though Fukushima had those hours, there were so many complications that the workers or those heroes were unable to save the day. They prevented much worse, but they were unable to prevent three reactor cores from melting down.
And just to get a sense of, you mentioned the extraordinary nature of this disaster, how still there's so much of this plant that you can't get near, and they're still pouring water in all the time to cool it down and trying to store that water. And so much of, during the emergency, all that water went out into the ocean, and right offshore was the USS Ronald Reagan, this big nuclear-powered aircraft carrier that was whose drinking water and showering water comes from a desalinization plant aboard that was sucking up all of this contaminated water. So even the rescuers were contaminated, but nothing like the 80,000 people who have been displaced, and the cost of the cleanup and victim compensation is apparently going to be at least $125 billion. And on top of that, Japan's economy, apparently, its whole economic recovery is in jeopardy because of the tremendous balance of payments problems they have with importing a record amount of natural liquefied gas to make up for the loss of these nuclear power plants. Last year, that cost the Japanese $69 billion. So this is an ongoing disaster. And when you say, you know, you've got to factor in the benefits of nuclear power as opposed to the downside if something goes wrong, I mean, I'm just factoring in more of the downside there. It seems almost endless.
Well, it's not endless, but it is a very long path. I mean, they're going to ring up a lot of cash registers for many decades because the costs are enormous. If you don't get it right, the costs are enormous. If you do get it right, the benefits are enormous too. I mean, that's the reason people keep trying this, is that if you get it right, the benefits from, you know, the footprint. My mother's family came from West Virginia, where coal mining has caused some problems over the years. But the environmental footprint from nuclear power, the amount of fuel that you need, the material you need is so small that if you get it right, you get a lot of benefits. But if you get it wrong one day, you can seriously undermine all those benefits from all that time. So the trick is to, as Admiral Rickover strove to achieve, was to derive the benefits from this technology without incurring its downsides even once.
But the fact that we have to depend upon an industry to get it right 100% of the time, that is in itself, apparently, just like the Japanese industry, too cozy a relationship with its regulators. And you work for the NRC, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and my understanding is that they still haven't implemented much of the task force that was set up to learn from the Fukushima accident in terms of light water reactors here in the United States. I think, 23 of them that are identical to the ones that melted down in Japan? And
there are 23 that are very identical, but the 100 reactors that we have operating today in the United States, if any of those had been in Fukushima's place at that time, the outcome would have been the same. None of our plants are designed to endure that kind of challenge. So Japan wasn't different from us in that regard. We had better luck than they did, but it wasn't that there was a Japanese fault. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission, to its credit, does frequently take actions to prevent plants from being safer. For example, in late 2010, before Fukushima happened, the NRC identified some problems with flood protection at the Fort Calhoun plant in Nebraska, and they made that owner upgrade those flood protection measures. In June of 2011, the Missouri River flooded, and actually that plant became an island in the Missouri River for about 2 weeks. So the NRC's actions about 6 months earlier made that plant much better prepared for the challenge it faced that June. So the NRC is not always a lapdog, not always a some people say that NRC is the Nuclear Rubber Stamp Committee. It's not, you know, they have at times enforced regulations. Our concern with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is consistent enforcement. It's one thing to have high standards that protect, don't reduce the risk to zero, but reduce it to an acceptably low level. But when you set the safety bar and then watch plants limbo beneath it, that's just inviting disaster.
Well, what's happening then at the Millstone Power Station in New London, Connecticut? It's supposedly trying to upgrade to put on a storage dome to contain a Fukushima-type disaster?
Yeah, Millstone, one of the orders that the NRC issued plant owners to undertake a year after the Fukushima accident was to better prepare for bad days like that caused by acts of nature. Millstone is spending approximately $10 million for a hardened building that will store portable pumps and portable generators that could be used if something takes out the normal array of equipment, such as the tsunami at Fukushima. In that eventuality, workers will enter that building, move that portable generators, portable pumps, in order to provide cooling water from the ocean, in Millstone's case, into the reactor cores to prevent it becoming the next Fukushima. The oddity about that hardened building is that it's one of the purposes for this building is in case of a severe earthquake, workers are supposed to be able to go in that building and use that equipment to save the day. But the building's not being designed for severe earthquakes. It's being designed for modest earthquakes. So that's because its owner can't justify to the board of directors to spend the money to have a more robust, more hardened building. The NRC is accepting less, so that's what they're paying for. So in some respects, it's a safety net, but it's not. It's made out of twine instead of stronger rope.
Well, David Luckbaum, I thank you so much for joining us here today and for your new book, Fukushima, The Story of a Nuclear Disaster.
Thank you, Ian. I appreciate the time.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Grant Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.